This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy. It's not an easy time to be a central banker. Attention is shifting towards the array of risks that threaten Britain and the world with new crises. There are obvious and immediate dangers of trade wars and a no-deal Brexit, as well as a rising tide of authoritarianism and populist insurgencies against elites, often with central bankers in the firing line. Over all this looms the existential question of climate change and its economic and human consequences. So this week we're asking, how do central banks deal with a riskier world? My guest is Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England. He started his career as a banker, going on to head the Bank of Canada and serve 7 years as the chairman of the Financial Stability Board. He's been in post here in London in Threadneedle Street since 2013, but his tenure is coming to an end next year. He's been in the news this week as a possible candidate to replace Christine Lagarde as head of the International Monetary Fund. But he's with us today in his capacity as Governor of the Bank of England. Mark Carney, welcome to The Economist Asks.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Anne.
Combating climate change has often been framed as a kind of threat to the economy, in opposition to green reform, sometimes framed as overregulation or potential job losses and expense. But are we now at a moment where the failure to act is the bigger threat to growth?
From a medium-term perspective, I would agree with that characterization. Now, that starts with the assumption, shall I put it that way, that there will be some form of transition at some point to a lower carbon economy. Now, of course, the objective is a smooth transition to a net zero carbon economy to really stabilize temperatures. But let's take that there will be some form of transition. Now, if that transition comes late, it will be much more abrupt. It'll be much more destabilizing versus a steady, predictable, and credible transition that is to some extent underway, but gradually gathering momentum. And in that event, what we will see both in financial markets, investing, but in the real economy, is transition adjustment being pulled forward and many more opportunities coming out instead of risks manifesting.
I suppose layman's sort of version of that, and tell me if this is right or not, is that you want to change the balance of the debate away from thinking, well, what are the risks of acting on climate change, to just much more in the foreground, what are the risks of not doing so?
That's exactly right. So one of the things that the Bank of England people may not know, but we oversee the insurance industry in the UK. So fourth largest insurance industry in the world, the biggest reinsurance sector, maybe most sophisticated. What they're very good is at managing actual physical manifestations, if you will, risks of crystallization of climate change risks today. But the bigger risks, and again, you're rightly putting it as a risk slash opportunity, the bigger risks are about the transition of the economy of where we are to where we need to get to in terms of a lower, ultimately net zero economy. And that's the so-called transition risk. And so it's the companies that are thinking about, or the whether they're financial or in the real economy, that are thinking about how resilient is their strategy to a lower carbon economy. Are they getting a bit ahead of this so that they're better prepared for that and they're starting to realize some of those opportunities? And that's what we're seeing to varying degrees in varying sectors.
What kind of climate shock would you say could do damage to the economy such that we might have to change a lot of our thinking, a lot of our modeling in order to avoid that?
Well, the way we have framed this is that we're probably – I'll give you some examples in a moment, but let me give you the big picture first, which is climate change. We've termed it as a tragedy of the horizon. Famous concept, the tragedy of the commons, and I know you go to the countryside and you know the importance of enclosure movement. So in other words, that you know when there's a common area or a common fishing area or grazing area, nobody owns it, it's not well managed, it gets overgrazed. Climate is a tragedy of the horizon because by the time that these major physical risks manifest from an everyday perspective, it's too late. It's too late to stabilize the climate at any realistic. That's at least the scientific advice. If we're waiting for a series of big climate shocks to adjust, we could be waiting too long. And of course, that's the, you know, so who is supposed to take the longer term perspective and bring the future into the present? Well, you start with that's why we have governments. That's why you elect governments to take that multi-year approach. What's happening in financial markets, though, is that investors and providers of capital, whether they're banks or asset managers, are starting to think about, they're seeing that horizon. I'll give you one number around that, $120 trillion of assets or balance sheet under management, now wants climate disclosure from public companies, signed up to something called the TCFD. And so they're seeing that horizon, and they want information about, at a minimum, they want information about how companies are reacting to that.
So is fighting climate change something that big institutions, that Bank of England, you put yourself on the map with this then? You've taken some criticism as a result.
There's a surprise, Anne. You do something as a public figure, as a central banker, and you get criticism. You always get criticism.
True. Okay, but I'll stay on that if I may. And the core of the criticism is that it is such a big topic. It would be in danger of sort of taking over the day job. So what would you say to those who say, well, you know, you should be focusing more on other aspects of economic and financial well-being, and climate change is more properly the job of elected governments to look after?
A couple of things. First, I referenced earlier that we oversee the insurance sector. Walk down the street, talk to any insurance CEO, risk manager in the property and casualty side or in the reinsurance side. This is the biggest risk that they're managing against. Now, they're fortunate in that they get to reprice their products on an annual basis. They adjust the pricing, they adjust the coverage. But so we have to do this for our day job. Secondly, when you look at the banking sector, for which we're also the regulator, 3/4 of the banks, 11 trillion of assets in London, view this as a financial risk. So we're the regulator, they view it as a financial risk. They're thinking about how to manage against it. And then the third thing is that we have a responsibility to think about the big risk to so-called financial stability. What can disrupt the functioning of the financial system? And these risks, and it's not just what I described in insurance, it's not just what I described for the banks, although those are important components. These risks of the transition of where we are today to where we're going, these are some of the biggest financial risks in the medium term.
It doesn't sound like you feel you've overstepped.
Not at all. No, I think we're.
Are you going to be even more outspoken?
Well, this
is the place to do it.
I very much appreciate the platform. What's happening, I think, is that the debate, discussion, the analysis, and most importantly, the allocation of capital is coming to where we have been. So if we were 4 years ago, my $120 trillion figure would have been zero. If it had been then, it was, which were the central banks, the regulators effectively, talking about these issues, it would have been relatively few. We are now joined up with central banks and supervisors from China to Europe to Latin America, and that cover 50% of global emissions. So that, the so-called Network for Greening the Financial System. So this is mainstream.
How do you feel about your own carbon footprint? I think I got a colleague who knows this area better than me to do some of the math here. And he pointed out that 12 business or worse first class return tickets to your native Canada a year would represent something like 40 times the global average per person emissions. How much does that trouble you?
Well, it does trouble you. The question is whether couple-fold. One is, let's take a macro point, which is carbon equity, whether it's your carbon footprint anyone in this room's carbon footprint relative to the carbon footprint of somebody in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. And this is a fundamental issue in terms of where the ultimate transition is going to go. Are we going to get to a position of global carbon equity? What needs to be done? So that ultimately gets it back to the need to collectively go to net zero. And then secondly, in terms of, yeah, personal, I have a job. I don't take 12 business class or first class. I don't take first class tickets for that matter. Business class to Canada, unless you just floated that out there.
It was an example, but you must fly a lot.
Of course I fly.
And you fly
a lot.
Business class. So your carbon footprint is bigger than if we switched
my,
you into
my carbon footprint, yes, of course, yes. My carbon footprint is bigger than, certainly than many people, and it's consistent with the job of being governor of the Bank of England in the G7, in the G20. It's consistent with the needs of those roles. Now, look, I make some personal adjustments, and I'm not going to go into my personal life. Thank you very much. Let's keep it up into the bigger picture. In terms of the Bank of England, we have just committed in the last 2 weeks. We've already reduced emissions at the Bank of England quite substantially. We've committed to another 2/3 reduction of the Bank of England carbon footprint, which would include my own and colleagues, by 2/3 by 2050. We're, you know, in other words, on a path consistent with 1.5 degrees, which is the stretch goal of the Paris Accord.
And widening the definition of risk, or indeed factoring in risks that we perhaps were less aware of or just didn't exist in the same way previously, is always tricky territory. It's tricky territory for everyone in public life and the major institutions. So I wondered whether you felt that climate is a similarly thorny area for you as Brexit's proved in the last few years since you've been in the job, for instance, as both of them are in a sense about risk. Great risk and what to do about it.
Well, I think on climate, and I'll close on this, which is that you rightly said earlier that climate policy is the responsibility of government. And I think I've made that point as well. So ultimately, what regulations we have around certain industries, whether we have a carbon tax, you know, the various incentives around climate policy, including climate objectives, which Parliament has passed, we need to make sure the financial system can deliver under those scenarios, whatever scenarios are adopted. And so that's the way we approach that risk. Now, of course, by doing that, we put the financial sector and they put themselves in a position where they can also seize the opportunities. And, you know, it's the flip side. Our job is looking at risk, but having that strategic flexibility is crucial for seizing the opportunity.
And you've been clear on the economic outcomes of Brexit. You think it's a very, I don't want to put words in your mouth on this of all things, but a very considerable risk, particularly in the event of no deal.
It is a considerable risk in the event of no deal. It matters how it's managed. So transition, this is a very flexible, resilient, strong economy, but a major change, it's always better to have some period of transition. So we talked earlier about climate, which kind of the ultimate transition. It's better to start early and be steady. It's similar with whatever our future relationship is going to be with Europe. Now, can I make one point, a crucial point on Brexit, which is that, so as you say, this is our day job. Part of the Bank of England is worried all the time about financial stability. So when it comes to Brexit, the question we have to ask ourselves is not what might happen, but what could be the worst thing that does happen, and are, you know, is the core of the UK financial system ready for that? And if it's ready for that, then it's ready for any upside that comes from that worst case.
I understand that, but I think the accusation that you are, and this is not my words, it's, you know, the people's sort of doom monger, which occasionally does get attached to you. You're quite a cheery chap today, but you are sometimes accused of being Dr. Doom, aren't you, on this subject?
Well, I mean, as I said at the outset, people will, whatever position you take, there will be criticism, and that's part of the job, entirely fair.
Once you try to say, well, I have to give you the worst case scenario, that tends to be the thing that makes the headlines.
Look, it's us doing our job. For example, I'll give you an example earlier, which is, and this is all entirely appropriate, but it's also the reality, which is that we have been preparing since we prepared well for the referendum. In hindsight, I think that's clear. And we have been preparing since the day after the referendum for the possibility of a hard Brexit, a so-called disorderly Brexit. And that means preparing our facilities, but it really means making sure the core of the financial system is ready. And Parliament asked for that information, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have a couple of realities. One, we have to prepare the system. That's our job. People would rightly round on us if the country chooses a certain path for Brexit, It's a country's choice.
You hadn't done the homework.
And we haven't done the homework. And then the financial system is part of the problem. But the second thing, if I may, is the reason that information is in the public domain is Parliament demanded it.
Yes.
Okay, Parliament demanded it, and we are accountable to people.
That's also what you said in a quite tense select committee, but I suppose that...
There was nothing tense about it. It was a...
Maybe not on your side.
Yeah, well, I mean, truth hurts sometimes, and if you ask for something, you get it, and... Have
truth
to
hurts.
Deal with the reality.
So that is the point, isn't it? That the truth hurts as you see it, was that you felt you really had to prepare worst-case scenario outcomes. They weren't possible outcomes. They weren't predictions, but they were possibles.
Yeah.
And yet former Chancellor Nigel Lawson and other critics, including your predecessor at the bank, just saying, well, you got it wrong because you were far too pessimistic about recession hitting the UK immediately after Brexit. Are they wrong?
Well, they are wrong, yeah.
Because...
Well, first off, what we said in the run-up to the referendum is that we expected that the pound would go down sharply, that growth would slow, and that inflation would rise above target. That's exactly what happened. Sterling's down 15% relative to pre-referendum levels. Inflation shot up well above target and stayed there for several years. And the economy...
Growth remained a bit more robust than you thought?
Well, in part because we provided massive stimulus. So you prepare... You get the system ready, and you're ready to respond. And that's what we've done in all those circumstances. And then, you know what, people will take a view, but we're the ones who have to deliver.
Now, many people, particularly given this febrile politics at the moment, we're in the middle of a Conservative leadership race here to... you're smiling, it looks like. You were enjoying watching the Conservative leadership race.
Just the use of the word febrile, yes. But please, go ahead.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's right. Many people have been saying, well, this, you know, we do need a change. The next governor after yourself when you leave next year should be more of a Brexit believer. Is that something you would be sympathetic to?
It's the choice of the government to decide my successor. And it's really, you know, it's not my role at all to provide input. My role is to provide a smooth transition to that individual.
And would your advice be to the next person, whatever their views on Brexit or anything else, that don't worry about it being seen as that your role could be slightly politicized, because these topics, just two that we've just discussed already, do drag you into the political sphere?
The important thing is not to try to assess the political ramifications of doing your job, because then you become politicized. So if you're judging how certain political views will assess the everyday responsibilities of the bank, whether we're managing risks, whether we're changing interest rates, then you're overthinking and you'll make mistakes. And so you just have to do the analysis and take what you believe is the right decision. And can I say another thing, which is that all of these decisions that we've been discussing are taken not by me personally, but are taken by policy committees of the Bank of England, which are, on average, they're half full-time employees of the Bank of England and they're half external members. So there's an institutional structure as well, which provides an objectivity and a discipline to policymaking.
Are you worried that central bank independence could come under threat, both here, either because people are just much more, politics is more reactive to the role of central bankers. We've also seen in America President Trump attacking the current chair of the Federal Reserve. I mean, it seems whether one likes it or not, this is a hotter kind of seat than it was.
Well, there are big strains in the global economy, and with strains comes can sometimes come tensions. I will say about the system here is the institutional structure that has been devised over the years is very strong because there's that accountability to Parliament. That's clear, and it can sometimes be uncomfortable or tense, as you say, but you know it's right. Secondly, that there are clear objectives given to the institution, but those who take the decisions are not just one individual, but are these committees, and these committees that mix both full-time and external
advice. I love it when you talk about committees, but I'm going to move us on if that's all right.
But it's, you know, it's painful because it's easy to personalize all of this.
True.
And we can't fit the entire committee into this room, but the entire committee...
They're welcome anytime.
I'll bring them along next time.
It's a very small table. that's what I call a pledge.
Yeah, there you go.
Quickly, let's have a look at the UK economy. One concern that is around at the moment is that the Bank of England has been warning a tightening of monetary policy is on the horizon. But the data from the market suggests that they don't believe this or don't believe you. Why is this disconnect there?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. What we've been saying is that in the event of a smooth Brexit to some form of deal, some form of arrangement, in that event, what we would see is the economy pick up, particularly business investment, but the economy pick up, gradual building of inflationary pressures. I'd remind that inflation is at our target today, 2%, and unemployment is below 4%, lowest rate since early 1970s. So you would see some inflationary pressures pick up. And in that event, so there is a deal, there's a smooth transition, economy picks up, that we would tighten a bit. What the market is doing, entirely understandably, is putting a fairly heavy weight on the possibility that there won't be a deal or that there will be a very protracted period of uncertainty. And in that event, in the market's judgment, then it wouldn't be appropriate to raise interest rates. And so what you're talking about is two different scenarios, two different paths for the economy. It's the policy of the current UK government, and it is the preference, express preference, of both candidates to be the next prime minister for a deal. So at present, our forecast is conditioned on that. But we're able to state the obvious, which is if there's no deal, then the path of policy could well be different.
Well be different. Can you characterize that difference?
It depends on the it will depend on the nature of no deal. A sharp Brexit is quite different than the scenario the economy has faced for almost half a century. It's not just a hit to demand. Normally, you know, people spend less, companies invest less, when we've seen in various recessions. But it is a shock to the supply, at least for a period of the economy. And so, you know, all
would would that give you sleepless nights, that scenario, personally?
Well, it's a difficult, in many respects, an unprecedented situation.
Let's just finish by a couple
but
of...
But we will, you know, we're ready for it in terms of the financial sector is ready, and we have tools to adjust in either direction as appropriate.
Just a couple of cultural points to finish with. I mean, one is on kind of women at the top of major institutions, including some you know very well, Christine Lagarde, outgoing head of the International Monetary Fund, nominee for the new head of the European Central Bank. Good idea?
She's outstanding. She's absolutely outstanding.
Can't say fairer than that. Yeah. I wish you could write my performance review. she said it was lonely being a woman at the top. What are you doing to get more women to the top of big financial and economic institutions?
Yeah, it's hugely important. What we can do first and foremost is, you know, physician, heal thyself, and which is to change the Bank of England. So 5-6 years ago when I came, 17% of our senior ranks were female. We set a target for 35% by 2020. We're on track for that. We're at 32% now, so we've gone from 17 to 32. Now half of our recruits, both from university and external coming in, are female. That didn't just happen. There is a comprehensive approach to increase the diversity of the
institution. Would you like to see a female successor when you leave the room?
It's not. I defer to the government that makes that decision. I'm really not putting my hands on the scales in any way, shape, or form.
What's next for Mark Carney when you leave Bank of England to the end of January next year?
We'll leave the economy in good hands.
Rumour that you were enjoying Kylie Minogue energetically at Glastonbury over the weekend. I think not in your governor's tie and jacket at Glastonbury. Is that true?
I very much enjoyed Stormzy. I did. It was amazing. And yes, there
was a very provocative performance, wasn't it? He was not kind about the government and many other aspects of life in Britain.
He can speak for himself, and he does speak for himself very well, and he also puts his money where his mouth is in terms of, building a more diverse society and education. And,
but you just like the music.
I like the music, and I like, that festival obviously is the pinnacle in the UK, but one of the many great things in this country is just that whole world. And I personally view that as something that's unique to the UK.
You're an ardent festival goer, I think.
They're good. It's the breadth of what happens at these things. It's not just the music, as you know. It's the food and the talks and the crafts and all.
I mean, the podcasts.
The podcast, yeah. I didn't listen to any podcast while I was there. There were lots of other distractions.
Kylie Minogue?
Very good. Very good.
Yeah. Mark Carney, Thank you very much for joining us on everything from climate change to Brexit and Kylie Minogue.
Thank you.
We're keen to hear your thoughts on the topics we've discussed. Does climate pose the greatest risk to financial stability? What should the major institutions do about it? And for you,
Is it Stormzy or Kylie? Write to us, radio@economist.com, or tweet us at Economist Radio. You can subscribe at economist.com/radio offer. 12 issues for £12 or $12. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.